Today, do people think prices are going to go up or home prices going to go down? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Wealth Notice Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Steve from Canstar. Hi, Steve.
G'day, Martin.
How are you going?
Terrific, thank you.
Well, great to have you back on again. Now, you've just published some really, really interesting research, which really polarizes people's opinions between those who believe property prices are running away and going up and others are less certain and think they could be going the other way. Fascinating.
Yeah, look, I was stunned when I saw it because it is split two ways. It's you know, a bipolar solution here. 40-something percent are saying they think it's a great time to buy, and 40% are saying it's not a great time to buy. I've never seen anything quite split that way, and there are only 23% of people undecided. So we have really got opposite views here.
Now, that's very interesting, because I can tell you something else. I got the same sort of findings in my surveys too. You've got this bifurcation between those who are really bullish and really positive about property and those who are absolutely not. And there aren't that many people sitting in the middle thinking, I'm not sure, right? People have strong opinions on both sides of the fence, and they often don't agree with each other.
Yeah, look, I've never seen anything quite like it before. Normally, there's a much more a consensus kind of feel for these things. And you get, normally, if there's going to be uncertainty, it's mainly in that middle group who say, got six of one, half dozen the other. I'm not sure really which way this will go. This one is right out of the box.
So the question is, what do you think is driving it? Can you sort of segment them by types of people or income or what is it, geography?
Yeah, look, we didn't try, to be honest, because, you know, we survey a few thousand people and you think, well, look, we should divide this up into all sorts of segments and all the rest of it. But you start getting very small sample sizes and, frankly, I think you might start misleading people more than actually getting clarity into it. So we went with the total view of it. What I found interesting, given that we can't dig down there, is just what a contrast this is to the market we're seeing right now, where people are all rushing to buy property, there's not much supply, and prices are going crazy. Things are selling at auction for a couple of $100,000 more than was expected. So we're seeing a market today that's going super, super hot, and we're seeing this survey result that says, whoa, we're not so sure. So I'm thinking we might be might have to expect a little more balance moving forward in this property market.
Well, that's fascinating, because my surveys, being a little larger, perhaps can give a bit of granularity. So I think there are a couple of dimensions that I'm seeing. Firstly, there's a big gap between units and houses, right? And many people living in units or investing in units really have very little confidence that prices are going to go higher from where they are at the moment. And in fact, the latest data that I've seen suggests that in some places, unit prices are continuing to fall. So that's the, whereas houses, particularly standalone houses on relatively large plots, prices have been very strong, and many people still think there's more leg room to go there. So that's the first dimensionality that I see. The second one, which is also interesting, is the difference between close into the city and regional. So there is some very significant momentum in a lot of regional areas. So, for example, I've been looking quite recently at around Newcastle and around Wollongong and the Central Coast relative to closer into Sydney. And again, what I'm finding is that there are some very, very polar opinions. Those closer into Sydney, still not that positive. Those further out in the regions think there's a lot of momentum and more momentum to come. But actually, there's the down traders who are really quite worried about what prices are going to do. So these are people in the bigger properties with quite a lot of value, not sure whether it's going to go up any further. Should they sell now? Right. So that's another. And the other is that you're seeing all these first-time buyers still absolutely convinced prices are going to roar up and they're going to get left behind. So that's another factor that is there as well. So it is a complex picture. So I think the message, Steve, here, you have to go granular to really understand what's going on. But the key message is, if in fact, as you say, and as I'm seeing in my data too, there are some that are less convinced about the, well, frankly, the headline news saying it's all go for property. That's a significant data point which may actually influence decisions ahead.
Yeah, look, I think we're seeing a real reversal of trends of many years now, and that is that people during COVID discovered that living in a bigger property might actually have some benefits. The other thing they discovered is that they could actually work from home, two or three days a week, and could tolerate the commute for a couple of days if they didn't have to do it every day. And places like the Central Coast are ideal for that. Now, I personally know people who did that, moved to the Central Coast, said, look, I can pop into town twice a week and do what I have to do in meetings and the like, and then work from home for the other three. And, you know, that's really very, very attractive. And the other aspect of it is that apartments, and here's the double whammy, apartments in inner Melbourne and inner Sydney, the demand was actually fed by tourism and overseas students. And neither of those are still with us, so you'd have to expect prices to really come off for that style of property in particular, as some people are saying, I want to move out to the burbs and onto a nice big property or out into a regional area where I don't have all the hustle and bustle of a big city.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because those inner city apartments have very high vacancy rates. The net rental yield, I calculate that from the surveys, are negative in both Sydney and Melbourne, close in. Mm-hmm. So you can see a lot of people losing money hand over fist, right? Because they don't have anybody living there, or if they do, it's a very low rents. So that's another reason why that sector of the market is pretty weak. Whereas those further out, those who've bought, standalone properties, actually seem to be quite happy about it. The other interesting thing, and again, the ABS published some migration statistics yesterday to show that there was a net migration away from Sydney and Melbourne towards, for example, Queensland. So there's actually some interstate movements, and there was also movements away from close into town to further out. So that's further cementing this idea that this is not a single market. This is actually, you know, quite a complicated granular set of data, and people are moving away from some of those more central areas.
Yeah, and look, I've heard anecdotally people saying, look, I've been given notice by my landlord and the lease is coming up and the rent's going up by $150 that I can't afford. And that's in a very outer suburb of Brisbane. And this person is saying, look, I can't find anywhere to live. I can't afford what is being asked. And you look at scenarios like that and it sort of brings you right down to earth and says, look, this is not just it's not just kind of a macro trend we're seeing. This is a trend that is actually putting a lot of people in a very awkward spot, because people who have been living in those areas like the Central Coast and like outer suburban Brisbane are there partially because of the lower cost of housing. And with that going up, it's causing all sorts of dislocation in those regions.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. And in fact, I did some work looking at the Tasmanian market and Hobart, and a number of locals in Hobart are now excluded from Hobart. They can find nothing at all.
Yeah, Hobart has been an amazing property market. And who would have thought little old Tassie would be such a boom market? But it's been a boom market now for a few years, and the prices in Hobart are extraordinary. You know, for a little place of, 400,000 or 500,000 people or whatever it is, it's the property market is just a crazy, crazy high market.
Yeah, but consequences of that are that mortgage stress in Tasmania is higher than anywhere else across the country, according to my surveys.
Yeah, the job opportunities are so skinny down there.
Yeah.
You know, they've got tourism and not a lot of other industry going on. So, you know, they really are in quite a spot. And, they've got some real issues that they have to deal with, unfortunately, because it's becoming a tough old road for them sometimes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm seeing something the same in Adelaide. And over in Western Australia, what we've seen there is the property market begin to pick up. But again, same thing happening with rentals. So rentals now are going up quite fast because people are being given notice. The landlord then puts the rent up and then relets the property, and they're having no trouble letting it out at a higher rate. Except, of course, that property prices in Perth peaked in 2013 or thereabouts. have dropped dramatically and are moving up slightly. So from a capital perspective, many investors are still underwater. So it's a sort of a little improvement, but not a huge one.
Yeah, oh, look, it's been a boom bust market for so long, Perth, and went through that terrible period where the property spruiking industry did really particularly well there and put a lot of people into multiple properties, multiple rentals. And when the resources boom slowed up and new mines weren't being built and the fly in, fly out went down, all the rest of those things occurred, a lot of people lost everything. And that's what happens when, you know, people sort of lose sight of the longer term fundamentals of a market and take too much risk on one small trend. Queensland mining towns were even worse, where there was a mine there and a whole bunch of houses, you know, nice little two and three bedroom houses built around it. And when the mine closed, well, gee, the property was worth about 10% of what it was prior to that. Yeah. So, you know, people have to be aware of the fundamentals and find a market that actually is sustained by more than just one thing.
Yeah, I think that's very excellent advice. And unfortunately, we've seen quite a few investors, you know, catch a real big cold because of it. And look, generally, my own observation is that investing in units pretty much across the country is still pretty suspect. We've got issues, of course, with things like poor quality construction, strata fees going up dramatically, all those sorts of things. Investing in, you know, houses on blocks seems a completely different market. So it's a very, very different story. And interestingly, that comes back, interestingly, to the rates that people can get from the banks as well, because, in fact, the banks are, in some cases, now more cautious about lending to some types of unit investments, whereas they actually are willing to pay you know, lower rates or charge lower rates for standalone properties. So I'm not sure whether you're seeing that in any of your rate statistics, but it's something that's coming through in my surveys too.
Yeah, we're seeing it in LVRs and anything else, but there's a little bit that comes through in the lending principles, lending policies of banks, who at various times in the past and currently are saying, look, no lending to units in a suburban, in a city, Sydney and Melbourne. We won't lend to single-bedroom units. All those style of criteria are coming back in, of course, because they're the properties that are in oversupply and really just there's not much of a market for them at the moment. So we see all of that. The Gold Coast is interesting because units still have done exceptionally well in recent time on the Gold Coast, and they're very competitively being sought. But they're, of course, units on the beach, and they've got the benefit of that scarcity. You know, we've got beachfront views, and they're selling beautifully. But they've only just reached, in a lot of cases, the prices that they're at in 2013 or even further back, because the Gold Coast went through one hell of a downturn. Might even have been further back. It might even have been 2009 or something. So they've only just reached those levels now. So, you know, they've been really in catch-up mode now for, 10 years and more.
That's very interesting. And again, I find from my surveys, you know, people who are living in Sydney and Melbourne looking up in Queensland are still surprised as to how cheap property is up in Queensland relatively. And in fact, if you look at it in net investment terms, the returns are twice as good up there relative to Sydney and Melbourne.
Yeah, look, not surprising. I mean, prices are lower, so returns probably are higher. I think rents are still lower too, but it's the price of properties. And Queensland has a market that just kind of bubbles along nice and gently and doesn't go through any of these huge surges that you see in Sydney and Melbourne. And it means actually a couple of things. One is that people feel a lot more comfortable and safe investing in that market. But two, first home buyers can actually find a toehold. And that's the problem in Sydney and Melbourne, of course. The first home buyers are already so priced out of the market that there's a bit of hopelessness or a sense of hopelessness that sometimes drifts into their thinking. We don't tend to see that as much in Queensland because you can reach a property and get into the market.
Yes, well, one of the reasons why the bank of mum and dad is doing great trade in the Sydney and Melbourne markets, I did some research on that and was published earlier in the week, is precisely for that reason, that first-time buyers, in Sydney and Melbourne have to save what 10 years on average now to be able to save that deposit if they go the long route with interest rates so low. So they're obviously looking out for other ways to short circuit that, and one of the key ones is to go and tap your banker mum and dad if they've got money in their property and use that. And interestingly, banker mum and dad either using some of the savings that they made over the last year, or interestingly pulling equity out of their property, handing it down to the next generation so that that person can then go buy not necessarily sustainable perhaps, but definitely a lot of momentum there. The average from bank mum and dad, $90,000 at the moment.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. If people can afford it, I can see why they do it, and you know, frankly, it does help young people into property. And parents are very conscious of the fact that in Australia, property is a great way to not necessarily assure, but move further toward a comfortable retirement living. So, you know, if you get into the property market, at least you're on the right page in terms of being able to afford a decent style of living in retirement. So parents are very conscious of it. We did a great bit of research. You know, it's a few months old now. It's probably about December last year. And I'm going to sort of make up a number, but it's indicatively correct. Something like 40% or something of millennials felt that parents should have an obligation to help their children to get into the first home, but only about 20% of baby boomers had the same view. And I'm sitting there looking at this and thinking, boy, there are going to be some pretty disappointed millennials out there when they come to start negotiating that first home entry, because mum and dad might not feel that same obligation. Now, it doesn't mean they won't do it, but there's always the issue, of course, is can they afford it? You've got to afford it as well as want to do it.
Yeah, and a couple of observations. Okay, if you happen to have parents who have the facility to do it, that's great, but of course a lot of people don't. So that immediately creates a problem between those who have and those who don't have more affluent parents. The second is, again, in my research, a lot of the bank mum and dad arrangements are very loose. Not sure whether it's a loan or whether it's actually just a gift. What happens if the relationship blows up? But they're also, of course, taking equity out of their own property, which is great in a rising market, but you know, if down the track prices actually correct in some way, that could also create issues. So there's a bunch of really quite cautious questions that need to be thought through. But there's no doubt in my mind that if you can get that 20% deposit with the help of bank and mum and dad, avoid lender's mortgage insurance, that gives you quite a big leg up relative to other people in the market.
Oh, it absolutely does, and it's you know, I think most parents would say, look, if we can, we'd love to help, because it does give you a leg up, and that $15,000-$20,000 of lender's mortgage insurance is an impost, and you never get it back. You just never see it again. It's gone. So the benefit for you, well, the benefit for you is you get into the loan, but it actually is there to support the lender, not the borrower, and a lot of people don't really quite grasp that at first. But yeah, I mean, it's the way into a property that has least pain. But look, I agree with you that a lot of these arrangements are too loose, and they should be documented. You know, if it's a loan, it's a loan. You're documented as a loan. You have an agreement on when you'd expect to see some repayment of it, or under what sort of scenario you'd expect to see repayment, and you document it, because people's memories kind of get a bit vague. You know, they're excited about the new house rather than excited about when they have to repay mum and dad. And a lot of mum and dads do need the cash back to live in retirement and can't actually afford to say, well, it's a gift. You know, it's a lazy $100,000 that we're happy enough to part with and never see again. Well, not everyone can do it, and they don't. The parents should not be risking a reasonable retirement without a pretty strong understanding of when they'll get the cash back.
No, I agree with that. It's very important to document it and structure it and include things like what happens if the relationship blows up, you know, those sorts of situations. What happens if there's a forced sale? The other point it's worth just thinking about with all of these things is that, you know, if you've got two or three kids, are you setting yourself up for a real problem? If you give it to the first one, then you've got to give it to number two and number three. So you've immediately tripled the problem, as it were.
Yeah. Look, the whole issue of equity can actually destroy families. So it's not necessarily meanness in this. It's you do not want to drive a rift between families. And you know, you see families who, at the death of a parent, the argument comes out again. It's a weeping sore, frankly, in the family, where they say, look, well, it's all right for you. You got given this as a loan or a gift, and I didn't get that. And you see it time and again. So the whole issue of that equity, even though sometimes you think, well, it's my money, I can do what I want, you've got to be careful that you don't cause a long-term hurt to the family.
Yeah, I'll give you a final data point from my surveys, and that is, those who haven't actually taken the long route and had the discipline of saving, right, in the 5 years subsequent to buying and getting the loan, are three times more likely to default, because they haven't had the experience of having to save. They've had the seagull gift from the parents, right? It's all a bit too easy. And so I sometimes think that you know, maybe it's youngsters wanting it all now, but sometimes saving a bit and getting the discipline to save is actually pretty critical.
Yeah, back in the day, Martin, I shouldn't talk about the good old days or the bad old days, but back in the day, when looking at a loan, the banker wouldn't just look at how much deposit people had put together, but they'd look at how they put it together. And you'd look at bank account records, and this is before big data, so you're looking right back through statements and things, looking at the bank account records and say, what was the savings pattern that we saw here? Because if you can successfully save for a deposit and pay rent or something while you're doing it, then you can actually successfully repay a loan. And you know, it's a lot less discipline required to repay a loan than there is to actually put together money for a deposit. So it's a great indication of which loan will be repaid and which won't.
Well, I actually years ago worked in a bank and was making those same assessments, and I remember people rocking up with 3 years of statements, and we'd actually go through them together and look at, as you say, before big data. But you know, that point is a really critical one, right? Because a pattern of behaviour is actually hard to change.
And that's what the consumer data, right, the open banking thing, is going to just lay bare for people. That here's all your data on all your spending on credit cards and through your bank accounts. We know what you can afford. It's all there. It's obvious. So that's you know, it's absolutely tells the story.
Yeah. Well, the open data system, when it's up and running, will be, I think, another very important leveler. In fact, in many regards, because it's going to be actually data-driven rather than actually opinion-driven, or you know, or frankly, just you know, if you can make a really good argument. Fascinating times, so many different and conflicting signals. I'll be interested to compare notes again down the track, Steve, as this develops. I think it'll be an interesting few months.
May we live in interesting times. Oh, ouch. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think this is fascinating. And how exactly it'll play out, I don't know either, because the market has so much momentum now, you think, can it be stopped? But, you know, the surveys that you and we have both done do indicate more balance moving forward. And, you know, you look at how markets operate. Well, if home units do become a whole lot cheaper, then people will start seeing them as a substitute. So, you know, markets do take care of this in the longer term.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's going to sort of go up, down, settle. And I think, I always say to people, go granular, go careful, and do the analysis. Don't just jump in with both feet hoping, right? Because sometimes you can actually land on the rocks rather than on the sand.
Absolutely. There's nothing like a bit of proper planning and decision-making that's a little less emotional maybe than when you see the dream home.
Absolutely. Steve, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Martin. Cheers.
Take care.